There's a rap lyric that goes like this. I've got my mind on money and my money on mind. Today, I want to talk about the economy of not only the world, but also to take a look at where the United States is and then to bring it down to us on a personal level. There's a lot of events going on in the world, and it's always good to stay in tune. So what just is this money? What does money do for us? Well, definition, it started out the exchange of goods. The first recorded instance of bartering can be traced to ancient Egypt 4,500 years ago. Now, 4,500 years ago would put us right after the flood, or right in that time frame. So chances are they had bartering or some form before that too, but we have no physical proof of that we know of. The earliest coins were found in Mesopotamia, which is now southern Iraq, and that was around 2000 BC. Those pieces are dated. Pieces of silver of a measured weight were called shekels. Lydia, which is modern-day Turkey, produced the first standardized coins called electrum from a mixture of gold and silver and stamped with a seal that guaranteed the weight. The Roman Empire became the greatest trade center in the world around 100 BC, and that led to the global spread of coins minted in gold and silver and bearing the likeness of Rome's rulers. Transactions became too complex for straight bartering. It was too cumbersome to haul around a lot of heavy coins or large items for trade, so the value of silver and gold was first represented in banknotes, and later those banknotes became U.S. dollar bills here in the United States. We could go back to Genesis, the 13th chapter, verses 1 and 2, and I'll just quote it. Then Abram went from Egypt, he and his wife, and all that he had, and Lot with him, to the south. Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold. So, riches are attributed to gold and silver. A monetary system, a value of something, is placed on an object, and it's worth something of tangible goods. So how did that all get in place? Well, I'd like to take a look. Let's turn to Ezekiel, the 28th chapter, because the value of money, I don't think, came from just mankind's own wisdom or knowledge. I think it came from God. He established it and helped establish the monetary system. Let's go to Ezekiel 28 and verse 11. It's talking about Satan here, and he says, "Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, take up the lamentation for the king of Tyre, and say to him, Thus says the Lord, You were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering, the sardis, the topaz, the diamond, beryl, onyx, and jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and emerald with gold. The workmanship of your timbrels and pipes was prepared for you on the day that you were created." God established wealth and what was precious. Let's look at the city that he's going to be bringing down to us when he establishes his kingdom and rule here on this earth, when God the Father returns. Let's go to Revelation, the 21st chapter, and verse 10. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great high mountain and showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God, having the glory of God, and her light was like the most precious stone, like a jasper stone, clear and as crystal. Now let's drop down to verse 18. And the construction of its walls was of jasper, and the city was pure gold, like clear glass. And the foundations of the wall of the city were adorned with all kinds of precious stones. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third chalcedony, and the fourth emerald, the fifth sardonyx, the sixth sardis, the seventh crystallite, the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth crystal phrase, the 11th janathan, and the 12th amethyst. And the 12 gates were 12 pearls. Each individual gate was of one pearl, and the street of the city was pure gold, like transparent glass. We see that God actually has value to certain objects, whether it be stones, precious stones, glass, or silver. And he gave that also to mankind. So it's something that God has created. It's something here for us and has actually been given some value. At certain times, the value is more than other times. Right now, we see in the world that the price of gold is going up. Here a few years back, it was around $600, over $600. Now it's, I think, right around, I haven't checked it here for a couple months, but I think it's somewhere around $400, a little bit under. So it's been going up. So how on this world, if we were to look around this world at this particular time, how does the world economy look? Right now, the United States, their GDP, the products that they produce, is going to increase approximately by 2.7% to 3.5%. Now, this is a projection that the economists put to it, and depending on which economist you go to, but those are the ones that they're, the percentages that they're looking at. And if you went around the world, Britain is in about the same position, Germany, all are producing about the same amount of goods above of what we did the previous year, except for China. China's GDP this year is projected to be 7.5%. And if you go to the store these days and you're looking at different objects, when you pick it off the shelf, durable goods, you'll see the name of China on a lot of those things. I'd like to read a couple of articles. The first one comes from Bill Gross, who is in an investment outlook paper. And they always look for a way, for a position to get you in the end to buy something or a product that they have. And he's pushing bonds. So, but he's also looking at the world economy. And I think he brings several interesting things forward that I'd like to share with you today. It's called hedge money. Now, hedge money, he's talking about in his article about hedge money and the definition of it. Hedge money is the dominance of one country over others, not only militarily, but economically as well. There can be little doubt that we have an American hedge money. But while the United States rules the waves as well as turf and sky, I'm not sure, so sure that we are or perhaps will be the economic powerhouse we once were. 3 years of stock market declines, devaluation of the dollar over the past 10 months, and the inability to serve as the global economy locomotive despite massive monetary and fiscal stimulation suggests America's shining city on the hill may have lost some of its sheen of late. The U.S. of A., it seems, is becoming less wealthy by the minute as foreign investment is withheld and in some cases redirected to Chinese and other more attractive ports of call. Economically, we may have begun a process of hegemonic decay. The initiation of U.S. hegemonic decline can't be blamed on any single source. Excessive buildup of private debt, which is part led to an investment and stock market bubble, has been a primary culprit. Our overvalued dollar and near historic trade deficit are in the running for the hegemonic Oscar as well. But if all these be ingredients, there is no doubt that 9/11 was the significant catalyst, despite it coming more than a year after several of these economic and financial trends experienced their peaks. In the aftermath of 9/11, it became apparent to George Bush and the Washington Defense Establishment that future conflict would perhaps be not only perpetual, but of a nature quite different from Desert Storm over a decade ago. While the eradication of Iraq from Kuwait was a simple purpose conflict, today's potential invasion of Iraq is but one of multitude of steps that hopefully leads to terrorist containment as opposed to the eradication of Islamic extremism. Bush has, in no uncertain terms, said that our future struggle will be never-ending story as opposed to a single-shot kill. If so, investors must know that perpetual containment entails costs, not just monetarily, but those involving potential policy reversals that have formed the backbone of America's economic hegemony for nearly seven decades. That such a hegemony has been based upon, number one, America's military domination, two, America's superior economy, as reflected by the dollar's ascension to the top of the pile of the world's reserve currency, is unendable. All hedge monies, including Britain, since the fall of Napoleon to the end of World War I, have shared similar characteristics. As current leader of the pack, America has been able to implement policies, free trade, open capital markets, and strong currency, which have not only reflected its political heritage and philosophy, but have added dollars and cents to its citizens' pocketbooks as well as to SUVs in their driveway. But the U.S., unlike the British Empire, rests on a fragile foundation built upon consumer spending and trade deficits as opposed to materialism and trade surpluses, which characterize Britain's rule. These deficits, coming at a time of America's military expansion in pursuit of the terrorist containment, threaten to reverse our hegemonic benefits and end our economic domination. And dropping down farther in the article, it says, because of 9/11 and our necessity to fight a new kind of war, America is losing its peace dividend at a time when, because of our high debt, overconsumption, and reflecting trade deficit, we cannot afford to. Guns and butter will soon extend our global credit card to its limit. Our foreign lenders are beginning to make some increasingly urgent phone calls to pay up or else, and they are enforcing their demands by selling the dollar and buying almost any other currency that represents the economy philosophy of Ben Franklin, as opposed to George Bush. Dropping down again, the reversal of these policies in the past have promoted U.S. economic hegemony as a natural reaction by foreign creditors and the U.S. debtor nation alike to the future new emphasis on tariffs, containment, and the cost thereof. Foreigners have and will continue to sell the dollar and U.S. investment in fear of guns and butter bills to come. America will attempt to preserve the hegemony by biasing, in some case reversing, free trade and open financial market policies that do not favor the U.S. All of this implies that our peace dividend not only in the terms of lower defense expenditures, but U.S. domination. Free capital markets and free trade are nearing an end. We will experience a somewhat vicious cycle of policy reversal instead of the virtuous cycle of recent decades, which we led to higher profits and lower inflation. While we may not qualify as a trip to the poorhouse, I have no doubt that each event simply to the least some Americans a trip to a poorer house. Many of us will have to adjust either in the form of higher unemployment, an increased price for imported goods, or heavier indirect taxes in the form of higher inflation and interest rates. And then he goes on with his investment strategies. The U.S. monetarily is in a very precarious position around the world. We have and are going head-to-head right now in Europe with France and Germany, and some other countries are now getting behind them. A lot of this outcome will determine our future. I have an article from the USA Today. I'd like to quote a little bit from Greenspan on an article that he commented on, No Tax Cut Hurry. And he commented and said, Bush's plan could run afoul of the pay-go rules. The White House says its stimulus would increase the deficit by $33 billion this year. So that's already been passed. So it's increased. And he's already said that as soon as the war gets started, he's going to go back to Congress for another $20 billion. So, and they're projecting that next year we're going to add another $100 billion over the amount that we collect. So this is an ongoing bill or debt that is accumulating. The White House projects record budget deficits totaling more than $3 billion in both these years. While Greenspan split with Bush over the stimulus, the Fed did agree with the White House in its outlook for the economy and goes on about the increased GDP. It was interesting that during the comments from this in the sermonette, he mentioned that people are losing their jobs. I have an article here that came out of an investment magazine that I get, or actually this one came out of the USA Today, excuse me. And it was the cover story, and it goes, U.S. manufacturing jobs fading away fast. It's a situation that's been playing out across the country for decades, but has received increased attention in recent years. 50 years ago, a third of the U.S. employees worked in factories, making everything from clothing to lipstick to cars. Manufacturing of steel, aluminum, all these products. And just in this area, we know Kaiser's closed down up at Chihuahua. The Alcoa plant has shut down, and they're actually dismantling that and shipping that overseas to reinstall it. Those are jobs that are gone that probably never will return to this area, and they affect our local economy. So we're seeing that take effect. Today, little more than one-tenth of the nation's 131 million workers are employed by manufacturing firms. Four-fifths are in the services. And when we say services, that's like advertising, data processing, things that support a company but actually do not produce an end product. They're just input or trying to, you pay out to service or try and sell a product in advertising. The decline in manufacturing jobs has swiftly accelerated since the beginning of 2000. Since then, more than one, now this is just since the year 2000, more than 1.9 million factory jobs have been cut, about 10% of the sector's workforce. During the same period, the number of jobs outside manufacturing has risen about 2%. So there's a deficit there. In the service area, they've hired about 2% of those, so that leaves about an 8% deficit out of work in manufacturing. Many of the factory jobs are being cut that companies respond to a sharp rise in global competition, unable to raise prices, and often forced to cut them. Companies must find a way they can reduce costs and hang on to profits. Jobs are increasingly being moved abroad as companies take advantage of the lower labor costs and position themselves to sell products to a growing and promising market abroad. Economy.com, an economic consulting firm in Westchester, Pennsylvania, estimates 1.3 manufacturing jobs have been moved abroad since the beginning of 1992. So the goods are still being made, they're just not being made here in the United States. Other countries are picking up the slack. The bulk coming in the last 3 years, most of these jobs have gone to Mexico and East Asia, namely China. We see the United States is in a decline in what we're actually producing that brings us back tangible money, that gives us what we've been used to over the past few years. I can remember back in the 80s, we heard Mr. Armstrong and the church tell us that we needed to lower our standard of living. And yet, if you go back and reflect, some of the best growth as a nation has come the past few years economically. But we've hit the top, and we're now on the downgrade, so to speak. You know, we look at what's going on in Europe, and we're butting heads with different European nations on Iraq. They're uneasy about the amount of money that we have stacked up in debt to them. Let's take a look at, you know, when we look at events that we see in the paper, that we hear, commentaries, different things like that, but there's also another element that we need to be aware of. Let's go back to Ephesians, the 6th chapter, because some of these events are really out of any human hand. Ephesians, the 6th chapter, and verse 12. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of the age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places. There are elements that are going on around us. We know that God will fulfill His prophecies, and He uses mankind to fulfill those. And there are times in the past, we can go back to the Old Testament, let's look in Exodus, the 7th chapter, when he wanted the nation of Egypt not to let his people go. Now you think about it, he told Moses, go to Pharaoh and ask him that you can leave. But yet, God's whole plan was is that he was going to take out Egypt and their strength. And he was going to show his power. Exodus, the 7th chapter. And let's begin with verse 3. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart and multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. God said, I'm going to harden his heart. He's not going to, and I'm not going to allow him to give you what you ask, because I want to make an example of them. I want to show my power. Verse 13, and Pharaoh's heart grew hard, and he did not heed them as the Lord had said. He was set up, but God wanted and was going to bring about the conclusion he wanted. And Pharaoh was just a pawn in his hand. Let's go to 1 Kings. First Kings chapter 22, and verse 19. There was a prophecy that the dogs would lick the blood of Ahab. And Jezebel. So, let's go 1 Kings 22nd chapter. The Lord said to him, In what way? Oh, excuse me, verse 19. I jumped ahead. Verse 19, then Micaiah said, therefore, hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne and all the hosts of heaven standing by on his right hand and on his left. And the Lord said, who will persuade Ahab to go up that he may fall at Ramoth Gilgal? So one spoke in this manner, and another spoke in that manner. Then a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord and said, I will persuade him. The Lord said to him, in what way? So he said, I will go out and be a lying spirit in the mouth of all of his prophets. And he said, you shall persuade him and also prevail. Go out and do so. Now therefore look, the Lord has put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these prophets of yours, and the Lord has declared disaster against you. And if you go on, it shows that Ahab went into battle. He had disguised himself, but yet somebody took a shot as he was fleeing, and the arrow went through him. And they held him up, and he stood in the chariot, and then when they brought the chariot back, the blood that dripped out was licked up by the dog. So, I mean, he had a prophecy to fulfill. He had a purpose, and it was taken out of Ahab's hands. Ahab did not understand what he was getting himself into, but that was God's way of fulfilling his prophecy. So we can see that there are events that are going to happen in this world that God Almighty has already knows the outcome. And we're not going to know those outcomes until we live through it. But we need to realize, even though sometimes it's frustrating, you know, you look at what's going on and you think, you know, why is Mr. Bush so bent on going into Iraq? Why is this happening? Why is Europe standing up against them? These are things that are happening that are actually events that are taking place that are part of the plan of God. We don't know the outcome, whether it's going to be good for the U.S. or not, until the whole thing is played out. So where does that leave you and I? We just go rent up the credit cards and figure, hey, the end's coming. Let's have a good time on the way out. No, I'm not here to tell you that. We, as individuals, need to have our financial house in order. If at no time before, now is a good time to get it in order if you do not. Accountants will tell you that cash is always king in any economy. If you're in a recession, if you're in good times, if you have cash in hand, you're king. If you want to go out and deal with a product, recently I went out and purchased a truck for the business. Now, I had been dealing with a certain salesman. The salesman no longer worked there at this company, but he told me that he could get me the same deal from a Seattle outfit. He was doing other things, but he said, this is what you'd have to pay, and you just go through SeaTac over in Seattle, and they'll honor this agreement. And I said, fine. So I went out to the dealership, and I sat down. I worked with a new guy. I'd never knew him before. And I kind of told him, I had this agreement, and this is the way it worked, and, you know, it was so much over invoice, just a flat fee. And he listened intently, and I said, well, what do you think you can do for me? And he brought me back the price tag just as it was on before. And he says, well, what do you think? And I said, I don't think that's going to work. I said, I just got through explaining to you how much over invoice I was willing to pay, and that's the price I'm going to pay. Well, I don't know if they'll do it. And I said, well, that's fine. But I can go out today and buy it from this company right now for that price. Let me see what they'll do. They came back, and they did it. Now, they gave me the rebate on top of it, and then we talked interest rates. Well, interest rates at that time were a little higher than they were now. It was last year. And I'd done my research. I mean, I have a banker. I have a banking line, and I know how much I pay for interest and how much it cost me to go borrow that money from my bank. Well, they wanted 9%, and I said, no, that's not going to work. This is what I'll pay. But the reason I can negotiate is because I have the ability to pay for it. So they're going to deal with me. They're going to work with me. People that don't have that established in their lives are not going to get the same deal. The people that actually come out ahead are the people that have the ability to pay their bills, pay them on time, and understand what's going on in the market. And that's why they say cash is king. We need to work hard toward a sound financial base in our own families. Let's go to Proverbs, the 22nd chapter. Proverbs has a lot of wisdom. We're going to be in it for a bit today. Proverbs, the 22nd chapter, and verse 7. The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is a servant to the lender. In other words, if you don't have good credit, if you aren't established and understand what's going on, they're going to take advantage of you. They're going to make you pay through the nose. I have several employees that work for me, and it's interesting as you listen to the stories as they bring them in, how they, you know, ended up at the Joe's car lot down on Sprague and bought this hunk of junk, and they paid three times more than they should have paid for it at an 18% interest rate, but they don't have good enough credit to go down and buy a new vehicle from a dealership because of past history. The people that have the goods are going to take advantage. And so the people that are sitting financially sound are the ones that are going to come out in a down economy. And I think we're looking at the start. Like the article said, we're not going to be poor, but we are going to be poorer. As the dollar is devalued, as inflation takes in it, our dollar is going to have less power to buy. Let's go to Proverbs, the 3rd chapter, and verse 13. Proverbs 3 and verse 13. Happy is the man who finds wisdom and the man who gains understanding. For her proceeds are better than the profits of silver, and her gain than fine gold. She is more precious than rubies, and all the things you may desire cannot compare with her. We see that we need to seek wisdom. And financially, we all need to seek wisdom to get where we need to go. A number of years ago, as I was floundering in business, there's a curve. I was a good taper, but then I had to learn to be a businessman too. And at first, you don't trust bankers and other people because you feel like if they know too much about you, then they're not going to loan you the money. And so you try and only tell them, you know, and you always want to present your best foot forward, and you never want to see that, you know, them to know that you aren't really that good with money. So, you know, I mean, you're always trying to impress them, which you find out later that you really have not, that you've actually hindered yourself more. But through the process, I had a banker that actually took me aside. In the process, of learning business. When you first go out, your risks are high. They look at you and they say, well, here's somebody that doesn't know what they're doing. The chances of failure in the construction industry were either number one or two in the nation. So, I mean, you know, you got a lot of strikes against you before you ever get to the plate. But yet, they run numbers. They know these facts because they have to loan money on them. So, they want to make sure you have collateral. They want to make sure that if they loan you $5,000, they're going to get that $5,000 back, whether they take your house for it, your car, whatever. They want to make sure that they're going to get their money back. And so, not always do they do their homework, but most cases, they do. So, I had to learn business. Well, I had a very high interest rate. You know, in business, when you're borrowing money, they go so much over prime. And when they tell you it's 3.5 or better over prime, they really do not want your business. And back in 1979, 1980, when interest rates were 13%, and you're paying 3.5% or 4% above prime, it's a lot of money going out the door. But that was part of the process that I had to learn. And they didn't make it easy for me, but I had a banker that took me aside and he said, okay, you want to get that rate down, I'm going to tell you how to do it. He says, you need to do, you know, you got to have more profit in your business, you need to do this much volume, you need to figure out how to do this and this. And he gave me a sheet that scored my industry on what it owned, how much it owed in debt. And he gave me a goal of every year to where I would try and match that. So I had to learn it. And he took me under his wings, and I got a good accountant, and he's very conservative. I had a friend that was an accountant, but he was more on the edge. He liked to look at all the loopholes and push the envelope. And, you know, I mean, if you got an audit, you got an audit. But, you know, so I'd go to lunch with him, and I'd bounce things off him, and I'd go back to my accountant who was conservative, and I'd bounce things off of him until I figured out where I wanted or where I needed to be. And mostly I went the conservative route because that tended to work the best for me and my conscience, and didn't get the audits either, so that was good. But you have to seek counsel. And that's in our personal lives too. I mean, this reflected down in my personal life, but there are times that we struggle. And I have employees that come to me. My children come to me and they talk to me about, you know, different things money-wise that I can help them with, that I can give them things or show them how to overcome that. You know, they go out and they buy a car or they lease a vehicle and they lease it for more than they should. And they give it back to the dealership because they can't afford the price, but because they paid too much for it, there's a residual that's owed. So they roll that into the next car. And so now that car, they're loaning money at, you know, $5,000 to $10,000 over what it's actually worth that you can take out. And you know, people get themselves into that, and they get themselves into it at a young age. And what happens is you get caught into a cycle that it's a dead end. It just takes you into debt. But yet, when you're young, you don't see those things. You don't understand those things. But some of us that have lived through it, you know, we can teach our children. We can pass that on along to employees or other people that may come and ask us. But these are things that we personally in our life need to make sure that we're doing even now at any age. So we need to be wise in the money that we handle, the amount. You know, you look at it this way, whether you have a job or you own a company and you make a profit or you have investments, the way you need to look at it is God's given you a certain amount of money to manage. And so what do you do with it? How do you spend it? You know, some people call it a budget. Others like a little positive spin to it and call it a spending plan. You know, I get to spend my money on these things. But we need to go through, and especially if we're in a position where we're short every month, of not being able to pay our bills, we need to figure out what we can do to change that cycle. I know Gail and I had to do that a few years back in our process. We had to sit down and put a budget out. We'd put so much in the envelopes for food. So much went for credit cards. You had so much income, and you paid things as you went along. And we learned how to take accounts that we were in debt with and pay certain amounts of money on until we had one paid off, and then we'd work on the next one. We could apply what we'd already paid off onto it. And it takes hard work, and it takes sacrifice. There was a lot of years that we stayed in Spokane and worked here in the Feast, mainly because our income, if we'd have went to the Feast someplace else, it would have cost us more than we had in second tithe. We couldn't afford to be farther in debt. And what's hard is to watch all your friends and their kids go elsewhere, but you get to sit home. And, you know, we got to serve a lot at the Feast. It had its rewards. And, you know, now we're able to travel more. But we laid a good foundation. We taught ourselves how to control our money. And this is something that we all have to learn as individuals. As we go into a down economy or a recession, the people that are going to be hurt the most are the individuals that are on fixed incomes or some form of a public assistance, whether it's Medicare or things like this, because those are the first things they start to cut. So those people are the ones that are going to hurt the most. You know, a few years back, interest rates at 13, 18%, you could put your money in a money market account and make good money on cash. And the people that had it made good money. Guys like me, we paid it to them. And they said, thank you very much. We appreciate that, Mr. Miller. But, you know, that's learning how to be responsible. So we need to take care of our own personal spending plans or budgets and make sure that we live within our means. How about a will? Do you have a will? The first time I gave a financial sermon, which has been a number of years, I didn't have a will, but I had to include it. Since then, I have gotten myself a will. So, but it doesn't have to be elaborate. But what happens if you're a young family and the wage earner dies? You know, how does that work? There are certain things as husbands that we need to do. We need to be responsible. Things like life insurance, making sure that our children are provided for, our families are provided for, making sure that, you know, that first year that things would be taken care of, that they just wouldn't be left out. We had an opportunity a few years back to help a widow after her husband had died, and basically we walked her through bankruptcy. Their state of affairs financially was very poor. And yet, she was left with three children and no income. And it opened my eyes, realized how I had not taken some of the responsibilities that I should have in my life to that point. We need to make sure that our families are taken care of, either through a will, making sure we've got enough life insurance. And those are things that you have to, you know, at a young age, we'd buy all the life insurance the guy would sell me. 6 months later, I couldn't afford it, so I'd drop it. I mean, I've been through the cycle, and I'm sure several of you have too, you know. But term insurance is the most inexpensive way to go. And, you know, at a young age, it's something that we need to make sure that our families are taken care of. I mean, they don't have to become wealthy over your death, but they, you know, they need to be taken care of for at least a short period of time. Let's go to Proverbs 13th chapter. In a well, it's always nice, too, to leave your children something. Proverbs 13, verse 22. A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, but the wealth of the sinner is stored up for the righteous. So a good man leaves an inheritance. So we should, you know, hopefully, as we get older in our life, we've got enough put away that we take care of the things that we need to take care of, and actually our children will have something there of asset from the family to help them as they go through life. Another thing that we need to do is make sure that we're working, that we're doing things that generate an income. Let's go to Proverbs 14 and verse 23. In all labor there is profit, but the idle chatter leads only to poverty. We need to make sure that we're working, that we're being profitable. This day and age, we have things called unemployment insurance that takes care of our needs for a short period of time. It's paid for by employers, by the federal government and the state governments. But yet, that eventually ends. And we need to make sure that we're out looking, that we're active, that we're doing things so that we're actually making and producing. See that also, you can see that also in Proverbs, the 21st chapter. Let's turn there, verse 17. He who loves pleasure will be a poorer man, and he who loves wine and oil will not be rich. And verse 20, there is no desirable treasure and oil in the dwelling of the wise, but a foolish man squanders it. So we see that people that don't work, they spend their money, they don't have anything to show for it. Another thing that's good to do is to reduce debt. One of the things I found out with dealing with a bank was every year they require that I give them a personal financial and also a business financial. Now, they don't want to see that financial saying that my liabilities are more than my assets. And they don't want to see my liabilities grow every year. They want to see my assets grow and my liabilities go down. We have to, as individuals, make sure that we are paying off debt. Credit cards are probably the worst enemy in the United States at this time. They extend credit to people that cannot afford credit. I think this last year they wrote off, I forget how many billions of dollars they rolled off in bad debt or credit card debt, and they figure in this year they're going to write off the same amount plus another $10 billion. Now that comes out of profits of the bank. Now I think they have overextended the credit line to a lot of individuals that they should have not done so, and so part of it they're bringing upon themselves, but somebody pays it. That money comes from someplace and goes some other place. So there are individuals. One bankruptcy lawyer said that if you owe on a credit card more than you bring in annually, your annual income for a year, if you owe more than that, you are in essence bankrupt, that you will never get out of the cycle. So if you make $20,000 and you have $20,000 on your credit card, he basically says you will never get out of the cycle. There's no way that you can pay it off. Now, you know, you take a look at credit card and interest rates, and there's ways to get those things reduced. There's a lot of organizations that help those in debt and high credit card debt. They take it over, make payments, with the agreement that you get rid of your credit card. And most financial planners or others that are telling you to get in control tell you to cut up your credit cards and give them to them. That you're not allowed a credit card. And if you get a credit card, you break the deal and it's off and the creditors come back and start to hound you. So there are ways that you can, there are agencies out there that are available that you can use. And if you're in that situation, I suggest you do it. You know, there is some debt that they consider good, and that's if you're buying a house, sometimes car loans. I mean, if it's within the income that you're making, there's no problem as long as it's in your budget. You know, houses are good. They give you something. They're a good investment, as normally they go up in value. Another thing that we should do is make sure that we teach our children to handle money hopefully better than we have in our past. We started at an early age with our children. When they got to school age, a little bit older, probably more like late grade school, around fifth, sixth grade, we started at the time that the school year rolled around, we'd give them a budget on how much they could have for spending on clothes for the school year. And of course, we put stipulations to them. They had to have so many pairs of jeans and, you know, a pair of tennis shoes and a winter coat. And I mean, we had a list of things that they had to stay within. But what it meant was they had to decide whether they were going to have designer this, designer that, or I mean, they had to end up with so many products at the end of the planning session there. And so they went out, and then, you know, I mean, it was like, well, I can't afford this. I like it, but, you know, this over here works fine. And so we had them making the decisions. They were participating, and they had something that they had to work with. And it was good for them. And it helped them teach the value of money and what they had. And, you know, most of us, as we budget our monies, we know how much we're going to spend. If there's a way that you can include your children and start teaching them at any age on how to handle money or to budget it or to work with it, they're going to be better off in their future. Another area that we need to make sure and do, and that is not to forget God. Let's go to Proverbs, the third chapter. And verse 9, Proverbs 3, verse 9. Honor the Lord with your possessions and with the first fruits of all your increase, so your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will overflow with due wine. God blesses individuals who remember Him. I hope I have it here. I have an article I copied, or I bought a book here a while back, a few years back, 9 Steps to Financial Freedom. It was written by Susie Orman. I'm not saying she's got the all the answers, but it was a good book for me. Talked about how to reduce debt, tells you about mutual funds and bonds. I mean, it gives you just a lot of financial information that are things that we as individuals need to know. And it was interesting because she also brought up the light that we need to be doing something with our lives as a donation. And this comes from page 266. It says, money flows through our lives just like water, at times plentiful, at times they trickle. I believe that each of us is in effect a glass in that we can hold only so much. After that, the water, or money, just goes down the drain. Some of us are larger glasses and some of us are smaller, but we all have the capacity to receive plenty more than we need if we allow it. When you make an offering, the glass will be filled again and again and again. I knew I always felt better right after I made an offering, stronger, worthier, more powerful. And after a while, I began to believe that there is no coincidence that after I made an offering, more money would always begin to flow my way. It's a principle that God has put into place. We need to make sure and not to forget Him. There's another thing that I think is sound, especially when we're looking at budgets and controlling our money, is that we don't forget our family. Let's go to Proverbs, the 15th chapter. We don't want to be too restrictive. I mean, there's a point. We have to be prudent. We need to do what's in our power. Let's go to Proverbs, the 15th chapter, and verse 14. The heart of him who has understanding seeks knowledge, but the mouth of fools feeds on foolishness. All the days of the afflicted are evil, but he who is of a merry heart has a continual feast. You ever notice how some people are always just full of joy? Doesn't matter what circumstance they're in. You know, they find the best in everything. Well, we need to make sure that we don't forget our family, that we spend time with them. Because a lot of times when you don't have a lot of money to go out and do entertainment and to do other things, you have to spend quality time with your family, whether you play games, whether you do things at home, to have their friends over. You know, we used to always enjoy on Friday nights the amount of kids that would show up at our house for dinner. And it was something that we could do, and mashed potatoes were a big hit. And they went a long ways. But you know, there's things that you can do for their friends, but you do things as a family, and they're enjoyable. And these are the things that you need to remember. You know, we look back and we look at how much we didn't have, but what did you do with what you did have? And family is very important, especially in times of stress, of times of need. We need to be able to turn to them. Friday nights were always special in our house, and it was very seldom that our children were not there. I mean, it was either a YOU trip or something that was going on. You know, now our children at our house on Friday nights, including the grandkids, probably at least twice a month, maybe three times, sometimes four, just depends. They still come home on Friday nights. That's the place to be. And it's neat. It's something that we very much appreciate. There is a time that's coming that all the money in the world is not going to do anyone any good. Ezekiel 7:17 says, all hands shall be feeble, and all knees shall be weak as water. They shall also gird themselves with sackcloth, and horror shall come cover them, and shame shall be upon their faces, and baldness upon their heads. They shall cast their silver in the streets, and their gold shall be removed. Their silver and their gold shall not be able to deliver them in the day of the wrath of the Lord. There's coming a time that doesn't matter how much money you have, what influence, what power, what king of what nation you are, when God returns, no money is going to save you, no amount. The world economy is changing. Let's make sure we, on our individual basis, are on sound financial ground, that the foundation we have laid is one of solid rock and not of sand. The way we handle our money now will affect our financial stability in the future.